Welcome to TA1. Everything you wanted to know about adventure racing and maybe paddle sports this week. Got Jimmy here. Hopefully she'll be quiet enough. Yeah. While we finish this introduction. So anyway, this one is one that's been sitting here for a while. Just I've been busy. Sorry. We'll get on track here pretty quick. Anyway, so I know we talked about canoeing, surfing, and fishing, fly fishing. So quite interesting. And I'll probably have to listen to it so I know what we talked about. I do remember it was fun. So I hope with that ringing endorsement, everybody enjoys the conversation with Jennifer. So yeah, let's get on it. I'm sitting here looking at 6-8 inches of snow, and now it's foggy, but it'll be 65 by the weekend, so we'll be happy. Yeah, that's it. So remember, slow is fast, take chances, not risks, and thanks for listening, and we will be back next week, I promise. Okay, bye.
Jennifer?
Hi.
Howdy.
Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, you sound good.
Awesome. I'm trying to get you on Bluetooth here. Who's the bird?
This is Jimmy. Jimmy may Hi, or may Jimmy. Not get to stay. So we have That's two, awesome. And I used to let him sit with me all the time. And then I started listening to the episodes, and they can be very annoying when you have to listen to them for an hour. Yeah.
Oh.
So she may have to go away. Jimmy is a female.
Oh.
So
okay.
We have Jimmy Lee and we have Stevie Ray, and they're both girls. But yeah, I don't know.
That's great. Awesome.
So, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Oh, nice. Probably not enjoying the weather that you're having there, but that's.
It's been pouring here.
Oh yeah, but 72 degrees, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So today it was about 20 and about 40 mile an hour winds.
Oh my.
Yeah, the thing is, I think I can keep talking because I got my things in too. Yeah, she's gonna have to go away.
Okay.
Yeah, you're just not gonna be a good bird. You go in there. So. And I have to put her in her cage, otherwise she'll be back in to join the conversation again.
Yeah. Hey,
that works good. Yeah. So we may get a dog in here. Chili may come in later too, but yeah. So I always forget to do this, but so introduce yourself.
All right. Well, I'm Jennifer Fratsky. Just turned 35. I'm originally from Portland, Oregon, or a suburb of there. I've been out here on Oahu for about 15 years. And I'm a ultra endurance athlete.
Sweet. And I'm not even going to say why did you move to Hawaii, because that's kind of a dumb question, right? Why wouldn't you move there?
Exactly. I was living in California for a couple years and found out one of the girls I went to high school with was living here. So I came to visit, and 30 days later, I came back with all my things.
Well, apparently it's working for you.
Yeah, it's great. It's great out here. I love it.
Yeah. So, and I got to comment, I'm assuming you still have the surf shop.
I don't have a surf shop. I was actually, I was subcontracting for a surf shop, but I do my own surf lessons, just, you know, freelance kind of on my own. Yeah.
Because so. you had the greatest name ever.
Which one's that?
The Jen's Surf Sup. As in SURF SUP. That's even better than most of the hairdressers have.
Thank you. Yeah, I definitely still teach surfing.
So is do surf shops, do they all have to have a punny name? Is that a rule?
Not necessarily, no.
Okay.
They do though, half of them do.
Okay, I was just curious, like, yeah. Okay, we'll get in. So I don't know if you've listened to any, but this conversation will jump from this side of the screen to this side of the screen. So, you know, we'll just go wherever it goes, but I'm going to start with a hard question.
Okay.
So for the next year, you can only either surf, paddle, or fly fish. Which one do you pick?
Ooh, I'm going to have to say fly fish.
Wasn't going to be my guess. So, okay. we'll start with fly fishing. First thing that comes to mind for me is fly fishing and Hawaii don't go together.
They do. So you're about to learn something.
I am.
You are. So the kind of fly fishing we do out here is called bone fishing. So I don't know if you've ever heard of a bone fish. They have them pretty much all over Florida. They like really shallow water. Actually, pound for pound, they're really hard fight. They're really fun to fight. I mean, they're wild.
Yeah. Okay. So that, I mean, I've seen that and heard that in Florida, but I didn't know that was a Hawaiian thing too. I don't think of there being shallow water in Hawaii.
There's a lot of, I know, right? It's like when I first moved here, I thought every wave was like pipeline, but no, it's, we have a very diverse, ecosystem out here and lots of different terrain. And there's actually on the side that I live on the south side, there's a lot of flats, we call them. So when it gets really low tide, it's basically just, you know, reef. You can walk out anywhere from, you know, waist high to ankle deep, and that's where the bonefish hang out. And I'd say the biggest difference, the struggle I've had learning to bonefish out here is when you grew up fly fishing like I did on the Deschutes River in Oregon, it's, you know, the casting style is a lot different. You're casting upriver a lot of times and your fly is floating down the river, you know, if you're doing dry fly. And then here it's a lot trickier because bonefish are very skittish. They spook really easily. And the way that you present the fly to these bonefish has to be very precise, and you have to lay it very calmly on the water as to not scare them. So it's definitely a whole different technique.
So is fly fishing a physical or a mental sport?
I think it's like both.
You get a lot of thinking. Yeah.
Yeah, it is. I always say, fly fishing is the ballet of fishing because it does require a lot of technique. And mental. I think everything we do in life is mental. The mental side of it would be, you know, keeping calm and not getting frustrated. I mean, you have to have a lot of patience. A lot.
It is. Fishing, sometimes you just go out there, really not even care if you catch anything, just the almost a meditation for you?
For me, yeah. I mean, 50% of the time or maybe more, I'm not catching anything, but it's just that whole idea of, I like to fish alone because it is very therapeutic for me. I kind of get in a zone whether I'm going out there. Fly fishing, I could more do with people just because I want to learn. But if I'm out there on my canoe, dragging line or trolling, I don't care because, hey, I'm getting a workout. And if I hook a fish, it's a bonus,
Yeah. Yeah. So did you grow up fly fishing in Oregon?
I did. Yeah. My dad, for years, since I can remember, was taking me to various parts of the Deschutes River and, different other rivers around Oregon and, taught me how to fly fish. And then later on in probably my high school years, he bought a drift boat. And that's when we really started getting into, drifting down the river, camping for 4 days at a time and just fly fishing and eating good food and having a good time. So yeah, it's in my blood for sure.
So how do I put this delicately? Were you a weirdo in high school because you went fishing for 4 days, or were you in an area where that was kind of normal?
I was a weirdo, but I'm not sure if it was because of the fly fishing.
Okay.
That was probably the icing on the cake. I don't think a lot of people knew.
So did you purposely like keep it quiet, or was it just like nobody asked, so you didn't tell anybody?
I was probably nobody asked. I didn't really have many friends, so
So we're getting that typical ultra endurance athlete background. Grow up, you know, out in the woods all the time. Yeah. Don't have any friends. Normal story.
We're just a bunch of weirdos.
Yeah. So this is a dumb question, but I'm going to ask anyway. Have you always had an affinity for the water?
You know, not necessarily. I mean, I think I've always been a water person as far as, you know, the river and all that. But, you know, when I started getting into the ocean, I was terrified. I mean, I had a kayaking accident in the ocean when I was, I want to say, about 15. I almost drowned. I got pretty severe hypothermia. And I just was, I got caught in a riptide, and I was so terrified. Even when I moved to California, you know, I was always in the back of my mind. I was always scared. So I think I've always loved the water, but I've definitely gotten more comfortable with it over the years.
How do you get back in the water after something like that? Is it just, you just have to, no matter how much it sort of sucks?
Yeah. And I mean, I think when you live on Oahu, you're on an island, you're surrounded by water. It's like your fear is, you know, 360 degrees in your face. So you don't really have a choice. So yeah, you just go for it. And I think you learn, you know, over the years too. Like I learned what my mistake was, and you corrected, and you just try to build that confidence again.
Yeah, I can see that. Yeah. I'm not a water person, although I seem to end up in the water a lot at races. I don't know how that works, but I have a healthy respect. But I'm also an idiot, because literally anytime I've shot a race on an ocean, which is not a lot, I look and I'm like, why is my camera bag in the water? It wasn't an hour ago. It's like, we don't have tides in South Dakota. So and I got to remember, like, oh yeah, don't leave stuff here. It's going to get wet. So fly fishing, were you paddling before you moved to Hawaii? Obviously, because you almost drowned. But what's your paddling background?
So interesting, you should ask. I actually had no paddling background before I moved to Oahu. I kind of got in. The reason I got into that kayaking accident is because my dad did not know what he was doing, and I didn't know what I was doing either. But I got into paddling, I want to say about 14 years ago. I was working for a surf shop out here, and it was when the whole stand-up paddleboarding scene got really big. And I started teaching stand-up lessons, of course, not knowing what I was doing, but I learned along the way. They didn't know, you know, the tourists didn't know. I didn't know what I was doing. But it kind of started there. So it started there. And then, you know, I got into, that's where I got into stand-up paddleboard racing. And then that just kind of took off from there. So I started later in life, I think.
Oh, yeah, when you're 21.
Yeah.
You know, unless you're from New Zealand, that's not starting later in life. You know, the Kiwis start at 3, but yeah,
I know.
Normal people. Yeah. So have you ever paddled the big outriggers?
I have. I actually, when I was doing one of the stand-up races out here, I got approached by the head coach for the Outrigger Canoe Club, which is one of the more prestigious clubs and teams out here. And actually ended up getting on the top crew and Tried to win Molokai several times. We got super close. I think we got third one year, fifth another year, second another year. So I spent a lot of time paddling those outriggers. And
what is, does that have, I mean, they're like big boats. Does, how does that cross over to like a kayak or a canoe? That, I mean, physically, is there any, are they the same?
I mean, I think it's, you can compare them because it's water sports, but I think the biggest difference is you're just a machine. You know, you're just a part to this big machine in this boat with six people who all have a different job, and you have to make sure you guys are all on the same page. So I think you learn, I definitely learned a lot about the ocean, and didn't learn anything about steering. So I think that's the biggest difference. If you're seat three, like I was, you know, you're more kind of the, just the powerhouse of the boat. Mm-hmm. You don't have to worry about steering. You're just paddling is pretty much all mm-hmm. you're doing. So I think it's more of a, you know, you feel like more of a piece to a bigger machine in that sense. And with outrigger, you know, it's just you for the OC one rather, you know, you have to steer the boat, you have to push yourself. There's no one relying on you and you're not relying on anyone else. It's like you're pulling your own weight. And so, yeah, I think there definitely are similarities, but they definitely are also a lot different.
So cool. Dude, is that kind of enjoyable sometimes though? Just get in that boat and just paddle, not have to think about anything else.
You know, it is. It's great. And that's why I loved, you know, sitting in the middle of the boat. I mean, not like I didn't have any job. I mean, I, you know, had to make some calls and all that. But it is nice. You get into a rhythm and you get into a zone. And it's nice to not have to think, you know, you're just doing mm-hmm. your job, which is just keep paddling.
So, and I guess this kind of applies to any time you're doing long distance paddling. But do you ever almost like wake up and think, how long have I been on autopilot? You know, like you have no idea how long you've been paddling just because you get into that zone.
You know, I think more so with OC1 when you're mm-hmm. paddling, you know, long distance than the six man, because with the six man, especially when you're doing a change race like Molokai or the Nawahine Oke Kai, they call it, you know, for 41 miles, give or take, you know, you're switching out of the boat every 9 minutes. So you don't really ever have a chance to get into a zone. It's more kind of like, it's a very quick turnaround, like get in the boat, get out the boat, get in the boat, get out the boat. So you don't have time to get in a zone.
I didn't know you switched. What do you do? Jump out? Somebody jumps in?
Yeah, it's actually pretty cool. So we do, so there's things called dry changes and wet changes. So dry changes are more like when you're in cold water, like California, where you get out of the boat into another boat. But these wet changes we do in Hawaii. It's basically, let's say seat 2, 4, and 5, they roll out of the boat on the right-hand side. So the opposite side of the ama. And then the boat keeps moving until that front of the boat hits those three people that are perfectly lined up in the water and perfectly spaced out enough to when that boat hits them, they're right in front of their seat. And you got to be able to pull yourself up and get in the boat. It's challenging.
See, I learned something already and we're only like 15 minutes in. I didn't know it was a relay. I thought you got in there and paddled for however long it takes to paddle 40 miles.
There are some races here in Hawaii that are, you know, we call them irons. So you'll paddle the whole time. But most of them are, yeah, they're mostly change races. Cool.
Okay, completely different tangent and we'll be back to paddling. How long did it take you to be able to pronounce everything in Hawaii?
Yeah. gosh, not too long. You know, I'm pretty good at adapting to language. So it didn't take long to be able to pronounce everything. Now, do I know the meanings to everything? No, but I'm getting there. But I mean, yeah, in 15 years, I know quite a bit.
Yeah, I would hope so. I mean, I suppose it's like anything, you're immersed in it. So you just, it just comes to you and you're hearing it.
So. Yep.
I would suck. I have a very bad ear for languages. So
oh.
I just say, what's that place over there? So did you surf before you got to Hawaii? See how I'm doing? I'm covering all three of these and then we'll go somewhere.
Yeah. So the surfing is funny. Like I mentioned earlier in our conversation, you know, I was surfing in California a little bit and I'm talking like I was a total kook, didn't know what I was doing. Had my board, I'd go out and fall. And then I sold my board because I had this vision that every wave in Hawaii was like pipeline overhead mm-hmm. and there was no way. And then of course, when I moved here, you know, I found Waikiki and I thought, oh my gosh, I can actually mm-hmm. surf. So I would say I didn't really start surfing until I got here, like actually getting into it. So
is it as bad as popular culture makes it sound when you start surfing someplace? Or is it a little more friendly than hopefully?
You know, it depends. It really depends. I mean, you could go out somewhere and you have a great time and you go to that same spot tomorrow and there's that one guy that just wants to ruin your day. So, I mean, for the most part, I think there's a lot of aloha out here. And as long as you know the etiquette and you respect, you know, the culture and respect the people and respect the people that have been surfing these surf breaks for their whole lives, you know, everyone's going to get along. So...
That's cool. Is it as laid back as we think it is living in Hawaii, or
no?
or is it like living anywhere?
You know, it's like living anywhere. I always tell people that vacation here. I think that, you know, people come and vacation here and they definitely do see the laid back side, the beach barbecues and all that, but you know, I think what everyone has to keep in mind is, you know, we're still out here. We're still struggling, living paycheck to paycheck. Everything's expensive out here. I think we definitely do have a more laid back way of living, but we still have the same struggles that the mainland does.
Yeah. That is a dumb question, but I'm known for my dumb questions. Okay. Endurance. When did you learn that you were an endurance athlete?
So I first learned I was an endurance athlete. I'm probably going to get the year wrong, but I want to say it was 2008 or 10, one of the two. I was invited by a friend to go to the Sea Paddle NYC in New York. It's about a 28-mile paddle around Manhattan Island. Mm-hmm. And I had, you know, I had just started stand-up paddleboard teaching and getting comfortable with the board. And my friend was just kind of like, hey, come do this race. It's, you know, a fundraiser for autism and can't say no to that. So I went to do it and it was the hardest thing I had ever done. And the first endurance race I'd ever done in my life, let alone, you know, on a board I wasn't familiar with and crazy water, and I just fell in love with it. It was like it kind of lit a spark in me. And that's just, I feel like from what I can remember, that's where it started.
Yeah. So that's kind of a common story with adventure racers, is they do one and it's just right. Is that kind of, it just felt right?
Yeah. And I think you either love it or you hate it. And I think most of the time you don't realize you love it until a couple days after. Cause of course, while you're doing it, you're like, oh, what am I? I'm never doing this again. You know?
Yep. Yeah.
But a couple days later, you're like, you start thinking like, oh man, like what could I have done better? And what can I do next? And it becomes an addiction.
Yeah. My running joke is, you know, I talk to all these people that do a race and immediately are hooked. But I never get to talk to the people that do their first race and never do another one. you know, there's a lot of them, but they're a little harder to find.
So. Yeah, they probably don't want to talk about it.
Yeah.
It's a dark time in their life.
Exactly. So, I mean, how did you progress, you know, from stand up to canoeing to, you know, kind of give us your history a little bit.
Yeah. So to kind of make a long story short, you know, it all started with that race. And then a year later, I went back and did that race again and actually did, you know, better knowing what I was getting myself into. And then I started racing stand up locally and, you know, Outer Island. And I actually started riding for Team Hobie. So I was with Team Hobie for a couple of years and ended up tearing my ACL on a training run. And that was the end of that. And that's when I kind of was already doing six man, just kind of recreationally. But then I kind of realized, well, my stand-up days might be over for a while. And I was getting tired of it. You know, I had just, it's very painful on the body. So I got into six man and I just fully dove into that because we were just such a competitive team. And, you know, we went to Tahiti and California and we raced all over the place and it was just really fun to be a part of a team. I had never done that before. And then I started, actually our coach later on was John Puakea. So the owner of Puakea Designs. And he, you know, had his new boat coming out and wanted everyone to cross train on the one man's. So that's how I got involved in one man. And I thought to myself, well, gosh, I like this one man thing. You know, it's like you get to go out and train on your own. You don't have to count on anyone. And then I started kind of doing one man races and six man races. And then I slowly phased out the six man because I didn't have time. I have a 12-year-old son. So for me, it was easier for me to, you know, hop on the one man and do my own training schedule than have to be somewhere 6 days a week training with a team, you know, not wanting to let anyone down. So everything kind of over the stand up and the six man and the OC wanted, they all overlapped each other. And then the canoe I got into kind of just randomly because there was a race, trying to think, it was the Yukon River Quest in 2019 and they don't allow outriggers. So I was forced to do it on a canoe. And then that's where I fell in love with the canoe. So now I only do OC1 and canoe, but my canoe is in Oregon at my parents' house. And I only use it for races that I can't use my OC1 on.
So yeah. Are you telling me that Yukon Quest was your first canoe race?
Actually, well, yeah, no, that was my first canoe race. And it was actually, it was a hot mess because I have no steering skills. My first ultra race was actually the MR340. And I did that on a OC1, which I was comfortable, you know, I could steer. But then, you know, I get thrown into this Yukon River Quest and I have this canoe that I've never even been on before. And I hear, you know, it was terrible. It was terrible. I got the hang of it after a while, but gosh, trying to steer in that Lake LaBarge was just like, no one gave me the memo that you're allowed to have rudders on a canoe. I didn't know you could. So I think I was the only canoe without a rudder in that race in 2019. Yeah, it was hard.
So this is pretty hilarious because this episode will be like next week, but the one coming up is with the Mississippi Speed Record guys. And we just had a conversation about rudders on canoes.
Oh, yeah. So, what is their take on it?
Yes, of course. Yeah.
You know, I'm funny in that way because I was always when I was in, you know, racing stand up. It was when stand up, you know, first started to get really popular and I never raced with a rudder before. And then of course, SIC came out with their rudder system and I refused. I thought rudders are cheating. If you're going to paddle, you got to learn how to steer on the stand up. And I was very gung ho about that. And I kind of feel like I'm the same way with the canoe. Cause when I was a kid, my dad actually had an old, you know, dugout canoe. And for me, it's just putting a rudder on it defeats the, I guess the genuine feeling of a dugout canoe for me. Like it's very traditional. And for me to throw a rudder on it, like I probably never will. Even if you tell me it's going to make or break my race, I'll probably never throw a rudder on it.
Yeah, traditionalist.
Yeah, I think, I mean, yeah, in a sense, with certain things, I definitely think I am.
So, but are there other technology that you embrace when it comes to racing? I mean, and I'm not sure what, because guess what? I'm not an expert in canoe racing.
Well, perfect example. So also for the Yukon River Quest, I was against using, a GPS. Not only did I hear a GPS at some point was pointless because there's so many islands that pop up and all that stuff if you don't have a good track that someone has already taken, but you know, I wanted to be traditional in a way where I'm using the map and I'm reading things and, you know, getting the feel for that. But I gotta say, after I used my Garmin unit for the Alabama 650, I'm like all about the technology. So yeah, I think once you use it, you realize how much easier it makes things. But at the same time, sometimes it's kind of fun to, you know, whip out the compass and the map and kind of do it that way.
Old school.
So
I think we've established that you're a good paddler. Are you competitive when you paddle?
I am. I'm super competitive. yeah, I am. Yes. The answer is yes.
Okay. And is it more important where you finish or how you finish? Does that make sense, what I'm asking? Are you okay having a really good race and not finishing as well as somebody else?
Absolutely. Because it happens to me all the time. It does. You know, I was a little bit disappointed with my results in the Alabama 650. But then, you know, I think about who I'm paddling against, you know, Sally O'Donnell. I mean, she has so much experience, so much more experience than me. You know, she's on a faster craft than me for those conditions. So I start thinking about those things and I'm not so hard on myself, but I think that, you know, some results I'm disappointed, but then I start to look at the bigger picture and I'm like, okay, if I was really competitive and I was really taking it seriously enough, I would probably choose to learn how to kayak because, you know, kayaks or surf skis are going to be faster, obviously, than an outrigger. But yeah, I mean, I'm okay. I think that, you know, I've only done, you know, a handful of ultra races and I'm very pleased with where I've ended up. And I'm actually shocked. I'm like, oh, wow, I'm actually pretty decent at this. So there's a lot of room for improvement.
So you're 35. You said it. I can say it again.
Yeah, proud to be 35.
So when do you think you'll peak?
I think I'm right smack in the middle of it. I mean, I think for women, bringing it back to Sally and just, you know, all the other women I've seen, Robin Benincasa, who's, you know, holds the record for MR340. It's amazing to me how strong endurance racers, these older women can be. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just crazy. So I'm thinking, okay, I'm 35. These women are, you know, 50s, 60s. So I don't know, maybe I'm at the beginning of it, but I feel like I'm at a prime right now and I'm just going to let it run for as long as I possibly can.
But don't you think you're going to learn so much? I mean, you're physically probably going to stay close to where you're at, but
yeah, I mean,
there's got to be such a huge learning curve to those kinds of races.
There is. And that's why I say these races are very mental because, you know, you can take, you know, a 21-year-old, you know, young, strong, vibrant, hyper strong, whatever kid, but then you throw someone who's, you know, older and wiser and knows the technicalities of everything and they're going to beat you because these races are not about strength. They really are not. I mean, I'm not saying you don't have to be strong, but the more you know about reading the river and timing things and nutrition and things like that, that's where it's at. So it is knowledge. It's definitely knowledge, and knowledge comes with age. So it's only going to get better from here, I hope.
Yeah, well, that's why the average age of adventure racers is like 83.
Right.
got all these old racers that are just smart. So,
there's my dog. Chili came to help.
Let's see. There she is.
Oh, cutie.
Yeah. So everybody knows, but Chili came from Chile, from South America.
Oh, that's so funny. I have a lot of Chilean friends out here on Oahu.
Huh. Cool. So the three big races that I know are the Yukon, the 340, and the Alabama 650. This looks to me like they're all different.
Yeah. There's a few of them. So you've got the MR340, which is the Missouri River, 340. It goes from Kansas City to, remember where the finish is. Yeah, St. Louis. So there's that one. There's the Yukon River Quest, which is 444. Then you've got the Yukon 1000, which is obviously 1000. Same start, different finish. Alabama 650, and then there's a lot. There's the Everglades Challenge stuff, which I haven't dove into. California River Quest, which I think is going to be a go this year. That's the only race I did never finish. I did half, and I had to quit. That was a hard one.
So
they're all different. They all require different strategies and different skills. MR340, I always say, is one of those races where if you're kind of wanting to look into doing your first ultra race, that's the one, because there's lots of people to help. There's lots of places to stop. You can't really ever find yourself in the middle of nowhere in trouble. Whereas races like the Yukon River Quest, you got to be a lot more serious about it, because you could, it's in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah, it's in the title, a Yukon.
Exactly.
Exactly. So,
yeah.
And the Alabama, that kind of is sort of, looks to me like it's sort of varied, almost some white water, some big rivers. Is that right?
Yeah, that race is, that's probably one of, if not one of my, the favorite race I've ever done in my life. It was so diverse. It starts out in a lake, and then you go into like this really narrow river where you got to kind of just be real technical about where you go. If you don't have the GPS, because the race organizer, Greg Wingo, he actually gives you the track. So you can't get lost if you follow the track. But if you don't follow the track or something happens, it is very, very easy to get lost in that race, because there's a lot of turns. There's a lot of, side little places you can go off. But yeah, it's a very diverse race. You've got the whitewater at Wetumpka, which they told me it was class 2. That thing looked like class 5. I was terrified. It was crazy. I don't know if I'll ever do that race again solely because of those rapids. They were scary. And then, the more farther south you get, you start getting into just the middle of nowhere. You're just nowhere. And then it ends out in the Mobile Bay, and then you've got your ocean conditions. So it's a very diverse race. You got to be ready for anything and everything. It's wild.
Interesting. Yeah, it for some reason, that's one of the races, I'd like to go shoot that. So it's a bucket race list for me, for shooting.
Oh gosh, you're just gonna love it. I fell in love with Alabama after this race. Just beautiful, beautiful. There's a reason they call it, the Amazon of the South, because it's just breathtaking.
Okay, completely switching subject for a second. Are there places on Hawaii that are just normal, fun places where locals go? Or is it all Hawaii, in quotes?
Yeah, there's definitely more local spots here on Oahu that, but I think social media has kind of ruined that for a lot of people. All the little secret spots are getting exposed, but there's definitely still places around here that, it's more the locals go to have their barbecues and their whatnot. Mm. And
yeah. Okay. Cause I get, for some reason, well, I know why, cause Jeff is a good friend of mine, but I've shot like 5 races in Florida and Georgia in the last year and a half. And it's like, I have this vision of what, you know, Southeastern United States is like, and it's like, we're kind of like out in the wilderness. So I just, yeah, wanted to see how my perception of Hawaii really is wrong.
Yeah, and it depends. I mean, Oahu's different from the Big Island. It's different from Kauai or Molokai. So it just depends what island you're on. Oahu's definitely the more tourist kind of place.
Yeah. So, okay, back to paddling. Yukon 1000. Why are you – why?
Why? Gosh, I think what appealed to me with that race is the no safety blanket. So it's more of a, you know, it's very self-sufficient. You're not getting the, you know, mandatory stop or the 2 mandatory stops that you get in the Yukon River Quest. So it's more of just, it's more of a mental and physical challenge for me and my partner. So I think that's what, you know, drew me to it. And of course, you know, I'd like to do every ultra race. That's kind of a goal of mine. I just want to do them all. But that one's really intriguing to me because it's, you know, it's unknown. And like I said, there's no help from outsiders. So it's like, you have to really, it's a true adventure. You really have to plan everything out. And if something goes wrong, you're on your own.
Yeah.
Or you're disqualified. So, I mean
hopefully it's happening this year, right?
Yeah, you know, I hate to be the pessimist here, but I usually like to be the pessimist just in case, you know. But I mean, Canada still hasn't opened their borders. I don't really see it happening. If it does, great, I'm stoked. But I'm definitely not, at this point, I'm not counting on it, that it is going to continue. But I know that at the right time, you know, it'll come. And
I mean, is that kind of, I kind of hate to get into COVID talk, but is that kind of your philosophy this year? Plan on stuff and hope for the best. And if races happen, they happen, and go.
That's definitely my take on things. I mean, I signed up for the MR340. I signed up for the California 100. And, you know, if they don't go, race organizers last year, and I'm sure this year, they're very, you know, lenient and helpful on, you know, okay, well, if we have to cancel it due to COVID, you either get, you know, you can either use the money for next year, or we'll give you your money back. So I'm not worried about that. As far as the Yukon 1000, that's kind of the biggest, like, sitting on the edge of my seat kind of waiting thing. But I'm actually trying to plan a little expedition with a couple of guys from Alaska, and possibly even Sally O'Donnell and a few other people. If these races don't go, at least we have something to look forward to. So it's basically Fairbanks, Alaska to Bethel. So it's not a race, but
expedition.
It's an expedition, and Alaska's, you know, open to traveling. Yeah. So if all goes down, you know, I still have that to look forward to. So I think it's going to be a good year. Cross my fingers.
my operating philosophy is, I think most of the U.S. stuff will happen. Things that I'm supposed to do overseas, probably not. But you know, but if they do, they do. That's cool. If not, well, I'm kind of like you. I got things that would be kind of fun anyway. So we'll work on that.
Yeah, and I think it's cool how, you know, last year how that all panned out, because I actually wanted to do the 340, the 444, the 650, and then the 1000. I wanted to kind of build up. But, you know, I obviously that wasn't going to work out, but since UConn 1000 got canceled in 2020, I was able to do the 650. So now it's like the 1000 is kind of what's next, you know?
Yeah.
So that, it all ends up working out.
Yeah. Kind of the grand slam of adventure kayaking, adventure paddling, I should say.
Yeah. And I heard there's even talk of a UConn 2000 from source to sea. So.
Wow.
I'm all about that. Well,
I mean, let's face it, today, the harder, sillier, I don't want to say dumber, but sillier race that race directors can come up with, the more people want to do them, right?
Yeah. There's always people like you. Definitely. Yeah.
Is there, I mean, I don't, those are most of the races, but is there anything other than maybe, you know, obviously you're doing the Alaska thing, maybe. Is there some other expeditions? I hate it, but any other bucket expeditions that you want to do someday?
Oh gosh. I mean, yeah. I mean, I'm always down to do any sort of expedition. It's just about finding people that want to do it with you. I know April, my UConn 1000 partner, and I have talked about doing the whole 2000 miles source to sea as more of an expedition and trying to set a record maybe for the fastest women to ever do it. So that's bucket list for me. And then there are bucket lists that don't have to do with paddling. Like I'd like to run an ultra. I'm horrible at running and I don't enjoy it, but for some reason I just want to torture myself in that way to see if I can handle it. But yeah, I'm down for any expedition that comes up.
Yeah. There's always a adventure racing. We can get you into that pretty easily.
Yeah. And then I know Greg Wingo, the director of the Alabama 650, he does this volcano race. Have you heard of it? It's a marathon race. I think it's like a three stage. One's in Costa Rica, one's in Iceland, and the other one is somewhere else.
Oh,
but I thought that looks fun.
Yeah. Iceland is I've shot a 6 day race in Iceland, and that's one of the things on the list this year that I hope doesn't get canceled, but oh, that'd be kind of cool. Yeah.
Yeah.
Something like that. Do you, I don't know if you can answer this question. Do you think there's anything that somebody would come to you and you would say, no, that's just a little too outrageous?
Yeah. Tell me to go through Wetumpka again. I'm not, I'll be straight up. I don't like rapids. And it's so weird because, you know, I can go out in the raging ocean and it's, you know, breaking 10 feet over my head and I don't, you know, I'm still scared and humbled by it, but I'm more comfortable out in the middle of the ocean when it's raging than going through a class 3 rapid. And I don't know why. Rapids just terrify me. So I think that's what would do it. You know, I specifically look for rivers that don't have gnarly rapids. So, you know, for races, and I don't think a lot of these races have, you know, gnarly rapids, even UConn, River Quest, what was that? Five Finger Rapids. If you go down the right side, I mean, it's minor, but yeah, that would be it.
Yeah.
I'm out for the rapids.
Yeah, but that's just because you're not comfortable in them. You could get comfortable.
Yeah, I don't know if I want to.
Well, I was just going to say, but you don't want to.
Yeah. I shouldn't say that. I should be more open-minded. Yeah, maybe one of these days that should be on my bucket list. Get over my fear of rapids.
Yeah.
But yeah, other than that, you know, there's really not. I mean, I love a challenge. I love being thrown into something that, you know, is uncomfortable and scares me. And the more challenging, you know, I think that's what kind of enticed me for the expedition was there's a 75 mile portage across the tundra that is supposed to be, I mean, it's just unknown and super sketchy. And that's what kind of pulled me towards it. I was like, unknown, sketchy, count me in. So yeah, I love it. I love it.
Do you always say yes when somebody says, do you want to?
No. The answer is no. Depends. Depends what it is. But for adventures and racing and doing kind of crazy, you know, endurance or even, you know, adrenaline stuff, I'm usually always in. Unless you know, there's going to be like a really high probability of imminent death. I'm in.
Yeah. Well, but you still say yes, but then you might reconsider.
Yeah. Yeah, I try. I think, you know, my whole thing in life is, you know, you only live once. Why not? Why not try it all? Well, most all.
Yeah.
And just enjoy life and adventure. And, you know, if you say no to too many things, you know, you get older and you look back and you're like, wow, there's no second chances, you know?
Yeah. That makes me ask this question. Do you look back at anything already and say, man, I wish I'd have done that? Have you had that chance to say, I wish I'd have done that already?
Definitely. I can't think of what, but I know it's probably happened. Because most things, if I can make it happen, I'll make it happen. But I can honestly say there's probably things I wish I would have said no to. Or that I wouldn't have done, but yeah, not really anything I can think of off the top of my head.
Okay, but, well, that's good. That's, you know, very few regrets anyway. So, okay, I said I started with a hard question, but I think we're going to finish with the really hard question for you. Can you tell me what the best day you ever had on the water?
The best day I ever had on the water. Oh man. Okay. There's just so many of them. I think the one that sticks in my head the most is one day I was doing a downwind run. So a downwind run is when you're going, you know, from point A to point B and the wind and the current is at your back. Yeah. So you're kind of flying. We have a really famous one here called the Hawaii Kai Run. And I remember one night, John Puakea actually dropped me off. It was after work. It was, you know, close to getting dark, but he said, okay, if you get in the water and you paddle now, you'll make it before dark. It's about 8 miles. I said, okay, I'm bringing my fishing pole. And he said, no, you can't bring your fishing pole because if you catch something, it's going to get dark. And I said, oh, I'm not going to catch anything. I just dragged the line. So we argued about it. And of course I won. I finally got to bring my fishing pole. And I'm about 3 miles from, Outrigger Canoe Club where I was going to pull out, and something just hit my line, just taking off. And I thought, oh my God, it's a shark. You know, it was huge. And I fought this thing for about an hour, and I was convinced it was a shark. I'm tired. My body's cramping. The ocean's kind of a little bit crazy. It's getting dark. I finally get this thing up, and it's a almost 80 pound Ulua, which, I guess on the mainland, you call it a giant trevally. I mean, these things are just pound for pound. They call them the bulls of the ocean because all they want to do is swim down and find a hole. So this thing was just stubborn. And I finally get it up to my boat and I'm like, oh my God, I just caught an Ulua. This is like a prized fish, you know, on Oahu, because they're just, it's hard to reel them in without breaking it. And I think I had 30 pound test on my line. Yeah. So I just couldn't believe, you know. And I think that for me was one of the greatest moments, because anyway, I ended up in the fishing magazine and everyone was, you know, calling me, asking me about it. And I just, you know, the first thing I did was call my dad and his dad, look what I caught. And yeah, for me, I think it was just kind of a moment where I was like, wow, this is why I do what I do. You know, it was awesome.
Sweet. It sounds like a good day.
It was a great day. I did not get in by dark, so it was a little terrifying, but I'd say that was my favorite day on the ocean.
Cool. Well, normally we don't get such a really cool place to stop, but that's a really cool place to stop. I want to, we'll keep in touch because I'm curious to see what you do. With the UConn,
yeah, definitely.
Races. You'll definitely be at the MR 340 with a whole bunch of my friends I know that are doing it this year. So,
Oh, great. Yeah. I mean, that race to me, that's the first, you know, ultra race I ever did. So it stays near and dear to my heart. And I'm really excited to go back and reconnect with old friends, I guess.
Yeah. I would probably think about going, but it's a busy, busy time of the year here at home with, I actually got some paying work. So I better stay and do that.
Yeah, definitely.
Some motorcycle work. So cool.
Oh, well, good for you.
We'll keep in the. I'll keep an eye on you this year.
Thank you. Sounds great. I'll keep an eye on you as well.
All right. Sounds good. Thanks. Thanks very much for the chat. And
yeah,
I'm pretty sure people will like this one.
I hope so.
Scott Miller says hi. From
awesome.
So. That was my guest 2 nights ago.
Oh, cool.
All right. Well, cool. Oh, I could even say this and it doesn't sound stupid. I can say aloha, right?
Aloha.
Sweet. Thanks.
Bye.
Bye.
Off, itchers, who's there? Riding giants off the lip.